Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to It's Rainmaking Time. We had a talk with Ellen Brown, the author of Web of Debt, in October 15th of 2009. And she is the author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. It was a blockbuster interview. And I am on the list to receive her wonderful articles at www.webofdebt.com. And this one is called EU/IMF Revolt, Greece, Iceland, Latvia May Lead the Way. When I read this, I was stunned and worried, and I thought that since this is rolling out so fast, that you would explain some of what's in this article. Let me go through a couple of points with you. I want to welcome you to the show, and thank you for taking your time to come back.
Oh, thank you, Kim.
You say here that Dubai defaulted on their debts in a declared moratorium on November 26, 2009. Does the world know that?
Yes, it was on the news.
But do you think the world knows that Dubai is bankrupt?
I don't know who the world is. The business news certainly knows it. They reported it. But it obviously hasn't collapsed the world economy.
Right.
But what I was writing about was the smaller countries that are in that same position and that have actually much better arguments for defaulting. But the screws are being put to them by the IMF and by the EU. This was Latvia, Greece, and
Iceland.
So I was arguing that they should actually follow the path of Argentina, and there are a number of experts who are recommending that, which is to just say, we can't pay, we don't have the money. You know, there's no international mechanism for declaring bankruptcy. There should be, so that you could have just an orderly bankruptcy and work it out properly. But what they have to do is just, you know, they just have to stand up and say, we just can't pay, we've got to work something else out.
In the article, though, it said that they were being asked, first of all, it had stated that the IMF and the EU are using austerity, like an austerity package, to try to get them to repay these debts by raising taxes, slashing public spending, and obligating them to deplete their savings.
That's what the IMF always does. They've done that for years, and they've destroyed many economies doing it. And there are studies showing that you're actually better off not complying with the IMF's demands. There was one study recently that compared Argentina with Turkey, which had gone along with the IMF, and Argentina is in much better shape now than Turkey is. Turkey's still struggling with this debt problem. So it's against the interests of the country to tell them to cut back on services, social services, and to be firing their state employees when every other country is engaging in stimulus packages. This is a time when we need the government. The government's the only deep pocket around that can get things going again. So they're being told to do the opposite of what everyone else is doing, because the idea, apparently, is to just drain them of their assets. The idea is to make sure that these banks get paid, these foreign banks. And the foreign banks are complicit in this whole problem. In Greece's problem started, Greece is a member of the EU, and they use the euro, and their problem started when interest rates were held unusually low to serve Germany's interests, but it didn't work for Greece, so Greece wound up heavily in debt. So they're saying now they're being told to fire people and put the screws on labor, and it's not labor's fault at all. And so they're protesting and saying they didn't come to power. Their government's saying they didn't come to power in order to ruin the social state. And then in Iceland, they have an excellent argument that they don't even owe this money, because the debt is being imposed on the government, and the government was not a party to the contracts. These were private obligations of private people in Iceland to foreign banks, and the foreign banks, just like our Wall Street banks, enticed them into things that were not good investments.
When we speak of, when you speak of foreign investments and private obligations, are you talking about credit default swaps? What are you talking about?
No, these were just homeowners that are going bank, you know, that are going bankrupt. The bank itself, Icesave, went bankrupt. This big Iceland bank, and that was when you may have read where Gordon Brown called it terrorism, and he locked the accounts of Iceland in England to make sure that these debts got paid. Well, it had nothing to do with the government. It wasn't the government's obligation. But the reason they're being leaned on to go along with it is they want to get into the EU, and the EU is making that a condition of membership. And, of course, it's the IMF. The IMF is the great enforcer for all these international banks, and they're set up pretty much to serve the banks, just like our Federal Reserve is set up to serve all our local banks. So they're serving the interests of the banks, not the interests of the people. But what Iceland should do is just reject the idea of being in the EU. I mean, that's what various experts are recommending. And the people themselves there was a vote recently, and a majority of the people opposed joining the EU, which was shocking because everybody thought that they would just have to fall in line, and because now they're so crippled, they would have to go along with the party line, but they're resisting. And these are European countries. You know, it's not like your small African country that has no choice and has to go along and gets exploited and just can't stand up for themselves. But these are Europeans these are the European brothers and sisters of the people who are trying to extract all this money from them. So they, if anyone could stand up, and the Greeks, I mean, if anybody is going to stand up to the EU, it would be the Greeks. They're just, you know, they've got a history of
they Alexander should start throwing the Great plates. The They should start throwing plates, Ellen, immediately.
So I think it's great that they're standing up, because it's not like you're defaulting on a just debt. I mean, it's, you don't want to say everybody who owes money should just not pay, but they're being extorted into doing unreasonable things because of these debts, and these debts were not the faults of these countries' government.
So these debts are a way to really take over countries. They're mechanisms used to they're circumstances used to take over countries.
Exactly, and it's been that way for at least since the 70s, when the dollar went off the gold standard in 1971 internationally, and allegedly, this is rumor, but allegedly Henry Kissinger went to the OPEC countries and said, we are going to make you very rich. We are going to quadruple the price of oil. But in return, you will
use the currency.
You will require that only dollars will be used to buy the oil. So that meant all these countries that used to be able to meet their obligations quite well suddenly had to have dollars, because they didn't have that many dollar reserves, so they had to borrow the dollars. Well, where do they get them? Obviously from the international bankers. And so that put them in debt to Wall Street, and it's been that way ever since. And then in 1980, Paul Volcker raised the interest rates to 20%, which was ridiculously high. I mean, if you look at one of these charts of compound interest, there's just no escaping from a 20% interest rate. So they've actually, many of these third world countries have paid their debts over many times over, that paid the principal, like, you know, six times over, I think it was, by 2000. But they're still heavily in debt because of the interest.
Why do you think it is that countries sign on without seeing the inner workings and the manifestations of what they just signed? What is making them sign in the past?
Well, in the past, I don't think anyone knew that was what was happening. But now it's become so obvious. You have these years of history, and a lot of countries have defaulted now. I think somebody counted 26 recently. So it's not like it's never been done. And then Argentina is the prime example, where they just said, we can't pay, and they issued their own money.
Talk about that.
Their own currency. I mean, the peso. They use the peso to get their economy going again. And that's what I think every country should do. And that's what is the big international push, is to get countries not to use their own currencies. And in the EU, you know, you have to abandon your own currency and use the euro. And if you need euros, you have to borrow them from you can't generate your own euros. So you can't borrow from your own central bank. Sweden borrowed from its own central bank and funded its government brilliantly well for centuries. They were the first central bank in the 17th century, but it was publicly owned, and it funded the government right up until they joined the EU, and then the EU told them they could no longer borrow from their own central bank. So they had to borrow from the, you know, international banking.
What do you think, that there is a international political and social pressure for the nations that are at the periphery, that are not in the EU, to join or die? Like, do you think that there's some type of, if you will, economic hitmen that go in and say, you either play ball or we'll totally take you out?
It does. That's what they're objecting to now, that they had been seduced into thinking that it would be better for them to join the EU, and now they're seeing that the EU is not operating in their best interest. They are being exploited. They are the... you know, the lower class of the EU that's being used by the upper class. So that's why they're objecting. And that's why it was such an interesting development that all three of those countries are protesting, and that they could well just step out of, you know, not go along with the party line.
Can you explain to the public, you did in the first show so eloquently, but could you explain as a context for what's happening internationally in the here and now, how these countries can create their own credit by establishing their own central banks? And also, could you explain, since you were the only person that put forth the call for state-chartered banks in America to establish a whole new economy, could you give a context for the listener today?
Historically, there have been two competing money systems. You could say for thousands of years, if you want to go back to the Sumerians, but at least for the last 300 years since we've had paper money. So the two types of money are government-issued paper money and banker-issued paper money. Now, the banker-issued paper money was supposedly backed by gold. They would issue banknotes that you could take to the bank and you could get your gold out. But the ruse was that they didn't really have the gold. They didn't have nearly as much gold as the banknotes they had issued. So they were basically issuing credit. They would issue notes for gold using this shell game that had been discovered, that people only come for their gold about 10% of the time. So if you just have enough gold in your vaults to respond to those 10%, and because gold is fungible, nobody's coming for their own particular gold, so you can use anybody's gold when they come asking for it, you can shuffle it around so it looks like you've got all the gold. So that system, the private banking system, has now taken over globally pretty much. And the reason is because of the whole interest mechanism, where they lend, because they create all of our money now, because virtually banks create virtually all of our money. All we have is debt money, except for coins, which make up a very small percentage of the money supply. And that's the only thing in the United States, that's the only thing the government issues. In some countries, the government does issue their own paper currency, but even that is a very small part of the money supply. Most of the money supply is credit or debt, so it's all owed back to these private banks. And because they don't issue the principal, they don't issue the interest, they only issue the principal, there's always more money, like a lot more money owed back than they put out there. And that's why, to get that extra money, somebody somewhere has to go into debt. It's a big Ponzi scheme where they've sucked in more and more debtors at the bottom to support the pyramid at the top, until now they've gone around the world and everybody's in debt. We're all locked into this system. But that's why we're at this critical period, where it's pretty obvious that there's this push to have a global currency, issued by a private global central bank. It looks like it would be the IMF, and the global currency that they're now proposing is the SDR, the special drawing rate.
Right.
But they're not proposing to issue this and give it away as grants to help, you know, third world countries. They're proposing to issue it, or they are issuing it and lending it to these third world countries, which means they'll put them into debt to the IMF.
If in fact the IMF becomes the international central bank of the world on a formal level, that is going to be issuing its own money, and that actually happens, they describe these special drawing rights as a basket of currencies. What do you think they're going to use in their basket?
I'm just wondering
what you think about that.
Yeah, right now it's all the major currencies. But the thing is, they're not actually putting those currencies. That's just a measure of what the thing is worth. But they're actually issuing new credit, just like any bank does. I mean, this is new money that they're issuing. They were allowed at the Pittsburgh G20
right.
to issue $300 billion in new SDRs to lend to third world countries. Plus, there was, got my numbers confused now. There was $500 billion. I think they borrowed $500 billion from all the countries, and they were going to issue them. I'm sorry, I've got my numbers wrong.
That's all right.
But anyway, they are issuing new SDRs, which means basically just these credits on a book. Like any bank does, you know, they write the loan up in your checking account. Your checking account is the dollarization or the monetization of your own promise to pay. The note that you just signed is turned by the bank into money. So it's not like they actually collect a basket of currencies and then that's what they're lending out. They're creating something new credit, but it's created as a debt, not as cash that will add to the money supply and help these countries where needed.
You're an attorney with a background in civil litigation?
Yeah.
My question to you is the EU going to have the legal standing to take over the world? As a practicing attorney, because I'm sure you know it's all about legal standing, do they have the legal standing to do what they're doing?
Well, they're not going to take over the world for sure. There's no way they're going to get Venezuela and, you know, those South American countries that are forming their own union. But you could envision several unions that all meet. The G20 is trying to take over the world. I mean, they're setting the rules for the whole world, even for all these countries that aren't part of the G20. And the way they do it is they just say, fine, if you don't go along with our rules, you don't trade with us. And because those are all the big countries, everybody has to trade with them or feels they do. That's another thing that I barely mentioned it in my article. But
talk about it.
The very exciting development is David Bloom has this book called Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and there's a whole group around that. He's shown that you can have these local distilleries, like farm-sized. So this is not big equipment that takes 10 years to develop. You can set these up quite quickly, and you can turn virtually any plant into a fuel. So these countries actually can become self-sufficient, even the smallest of countries. Like I did an interview with somebody in Jamaica, and they were saying, well, what can they do? You know, they don't have any resources. But they do. They've got sugarcane. I mean, they certainly have plants, and you can turn cattails is a great fuel for these things, and there's no other use for cattails. So it's not like you're taking away a food source. And with corn, they say that most corn goes to feed cows, and it's not really an efficient cow food. That the reason it takes so much corn is the cow can't use most of that corn. So if you put it through the distillery first and you get the alcohol out of it, then what's left is actually better for the cow, and the cows are, you know, they develop better on this food. So there are just much more efficient ways to use the resources that even the smallest of countries has. They said, I heard this tape, and there was this anecdote where back in the in Prohibition, the way they would figure out who was making who had stills in their backyard and was making alcohol was they would go to these fairs and look at the cows, and the ones with the fattest cows had the stills because they were feeding the cows the remains after the corn had been through the distillery process and had the indigestible parts, you know, had been used in another way.
I noticed you quoted David Bloom also in your article.
Yeah, that one.
Yes. Wow. What is a debt-canceling bond, and why did you mention it in the article? I don't think most people, I mean, in principle, you can understand what it is, but how does it work, and why is it being used?
In Argentina, when the currency collapsed totally twice, in 1995 and again in, I think, 2000 or 2001, and so municipal governments had these obligations to their workers, and they had literally no currency, nothing to pay them with. And so what they did was they issued these little bonds or IOUs, promises to pay. And essentially it was like the IOUs that California tried to issue, except that the banks wouldn't honor them. But in this case, the banks would honor them, and it worked. They paid the workers just in little IOUs that basically meant, you know, when we have the money, we'll pay you. But in the meantime, you can use this for a currency. And they did. They traded it. The banks honored them, and they traded them in the community. And that was a supplemental source of money.
Why do you think it is that Argentina, for example, is remembered as the country that collapsed and went into nothingness, but a great deal of the public doesn't remember that Argentina came back? Why do you think the memory is still with the fall of Argentina and not with the rise?
The mass media are controlled by six corporations the last time I looked, and these are all the banking corporation. I mean, they are a cartel, and so they've pretty much shaped all the information that we get. So the story we've gotten is not the real story at all. That's why I wrote this book, Web of Debt. I mean, when I realized that myself, it was just such an eye-opener, and it threw a different light on all of history. And so I wound up going country by country and just looking at what had really happened and what we had been told happened and what really was going on. So yeah, much of history we're not told, or it's there. You can find it on the internet, but you're not going to find it on your local news probably.
So what would you recommend now to Iceland, which is in very delicate shape, really delicate shape right now?
Well, I was trying to just report, but it looks to me like there's a good chance that they will not join the EU, or that they're certainly protesting joining the EU, and they should at least hold out for better terms. One issue is whether, or perhaps that was Latvia, I guess, there's an issue whether to devalue their currency, and I can't really speak to that. I read about it, and some experts whom I credit say yes, and some say no, so I don't know. It seems to me the risk of devaluing your currency is that it will now float, which means it can be, speculators can come in and devalue it, which is certainly what will happen. It always does happen. That's what happened to Mexico. That's what happened to all these countries, that as soon as they let their currency float.
Explain what that is to the public, too.
Okay. When we were on a gold standard, exchange rates were fixed. It was the Bretton Woods Agreement. The exchange rates could just vary like a small percentage, and so they were pretty much fixed relative to other currencies. So when you went into Mexico, your peso was going to be worth the same number of dollars, or your dollars were going to be worth the same number of pesos at any, you know, 1 year after the next. But then when we went off the gold standard, then currencies became like commodities. They traded against each other. So,
do you approve of that, by the way?
No, there should. I
think it's a form of economic terrorism to speculate on currencies, because you can break down entire countries doing this.
You can, and that has definitely happened. George Soros did it just to make a point. I mean, that's the way he tells the story later, but he virtually brought down England, which is, you know, that's not a
the Bank of
country.
England, right?
That's the power.
Yeah.
So just by short selling, which to my mind, everybody says, oh, short selling's all right. It's naked short selling that's illegal. But I think even short selling should not be allowed. Why should you be allowed to sell something that you don't own just to make a profit? You can only do it because we're talking about numbers on a screen. If you were talking about lawnmowers, you can't go sell, you know, a lawnmower that you don't have.
But it's also using the paradigm of leverage to do it. It's all about using leverage to do it. You only take a small you only pay a small percentage, even though you're taking possession of something much larger. You know, you can get in the game with a smaller amount of money, but you can wreak havoc with it too.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can't think of the word.
How do you explain short selling to the public? I really want the public to understand what short selling is and naked short selling is.
Short selling is where you sell stock, for instance, and use the stock market because that's the easiest to understand.
Great.
Everybody knows the stock market. And you can go in and you just say, I want to sell 1,000 shares of such and such, but you don't own the 1,000 shares. You have to cover later. So there's a time when the thing is due, and then you have to find the shares. And the idea is you're assuming that the stock is going down. And so if you sell it at whatever, 30, and then the stock goes down more, you can buy it back at 20, and then you get to keep the $10 difference between what you sold it at and what you bought it back at and replaced the stock that you sold.
Is there a central depository or some type of recording apparatus where people can go and look at where the short sales are?
They're all kept track of by something called the DCC, I think it is.
The DCC?
I think that's the...
It would be very interesting to look at the short selling of all of major events in the world that were either emergency events or traumatic events. Or any type of negative or terribly bad, like, negative events that have happened in the world?
Notoriously, there was heavy short selling of the two airlines that went down in 9/11 before it happened. So somebody knew that it was going to happen.
That's why I think speculation needs to go. Because what you can do is... You can bankrupt industries and companies and throw hundreds of millions of people out of jobs.
Yeah, and there was heavy, heavy naked short selling before Bear Stearns went down. There was more short selling than there were shares outstanding. In other words, these can't have been legal.
See, that to me is working at cross purposes to being able to have a company. It has nothing to do with what people are doing in the company. It has nothing to do with the way a company's being stewarded. It's literally a defilement of being in business.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
Who do you think it is that manages the laws, or how did short selling come into being? Do you know?
I just remember the name is DTCC.
DTCC. I wonder what that is.
And of course, it's owned by banks. The laws have all been, they're all in favor of the banks because the banks control Congress. And they control Congress because they have the power of the purse. They create our money. And so every congressman is beholden to them. And we know that even our president, one of his biggest backers was Goldman Sachs. So they have to dance to the tune of the people who put them in power. So the only way we're ever going to control that is to take back the power to create money. So that's why I think, to me, the most direct way to do that is to set up a competing banking system. I mean, we'll just play by their rules. There's no way we're going to get legislation passed that says, okay, you guys are all cheating, and so... You know, you have to go away and we're...
Right. It has to do with setting up a parallel system.
Play by their own rules. Say, all right, you've set up this game where banks are allowed to create 10 times as much credit on their books as they have capital, actually 12 times their capital.
Amazing.
So we're going to set up a state-owned bank. Now, our state has enormous amounts of capital, way more capital than your average private bank, and even probably even than your huge private banks. California has $62 billion in investments, which is a very interesting thing in itself. What are we doing with all this money socked away in investments when we're supposedly $27 billion in the red? But anyway, we have $62 billion in investments. We have $200 billion in real estate owned by the state. Plus, they have something like, I think it's $120 in revenues, annual revenues. So they have a lot of money. And if you took all that money and you used it for the capital base for a bank, I calculated you could have $4 trillion in loans.
That's amazing.
But, of course, you're not going to use it all for... But let's say you took that $62 billion that you have invested, and say you took half of it, $30 billion, you could make $300 billion in loans. That's enough credit to refinance the whole state, all the state's debt. So you'd be paying 0% interest since you'd be the bank. I mean, you'd get the interest bank back. And you could put all those people back to work that need jobs. You could refinance all those homes. You know, you could buy those mortgages off the banks, so you'd clean up their books so they could make more loans. And meanwhile, you could do some sort of workout with the people living there or rent it back to them or whatever it takes to get this whole machine going again. And you would still have lots of money left over to do alternative energy systems. We need a good high-speed train between L.A. and San Francisco, for instance. I mean, there are many things that we need, and the only thing we're lacking is the money. But the money is only a medium of exchange. It's only a receipt. It's the grease that makes things work. We've got the machinery, and we've got the people, and we've got the brains, but we don't have the grease to put them all together. And we can create that just in the same way that private banks do it, but the private banks are withholding it from us.
How many states in the U.S.? We're now in December of 2009. How many states in the U.S. do you think are either on the verge of bankruptcy, bankrupt, or are in trouble?
48 out of 50 states will be unable to meet their budgets next year or having trouble meeting their budgets. So I don't know if you call that bankrupt. You know, a state is not allowed to go into debt. That's the problem. But they really should be. The federal government is $12 trillion in debt, and they're still going strong. So a state should actually be allowed to operate on credit, just like the federal government does. But anyway, technically they're not, and so you just call that bankrupt because they can't meet their obligations. But as I say, all states have these huge investment pools that they don't touch, that they could actually use. So states have a lot of assets. I mean, they're not really going to go bankrupt. California says right in its state constitution that it can't go bankrupt. So you don't have to worry about that. I mean, they'll just overtax if they have to, or sell off all their state's wares or whatever. But they are definitely in the red. They can't meet their budget. 48 out of 50, and one of the two that can is North Dakota, which has its own.
Talk about that briefly, even though we covered that in length on the first interview. Give a context and a brief overview on the Bank of North Dakota.
They set up their own bank in 1919. When the farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers. It was the very same situation that we have going on today. And they were tired of having their money go out of state, so they decided they were just going to keep it in state, and they would have set up their own credit system with their own central bank. So by law, ever since then, all of the state's revenues have gone into this bank, the Bank of North Dakota. And so that becomes the deposit base for many times that sum in loans. And they can use that for in their state charter, they have a certain mission, which is to help the farmers, to help state development. So they use that money specifically for development. They do things like they have a very good student loan program. They give 1% loans to farmers, and they actually partner with the other banks. So the other banks like them. They're not don't feel competitive, but what they do is they take loans off the books of the other banks so they're serving the role that the investors used to serve for our banks until the investors got when they realized that this whole collateralized debt obligation was a scam, and they all went away, and that's why the banks are stuck with their bad loans and they can't clean up their books. But in North Dakota, the central bank, the Bank of North Dakota, buys up those loans from them and makes room on the bank's books for more loans. So they sort of backstop and provide funding for the other banks.
I have a question that I asked you in the first interview. Since the issuing of money is done on an electronic system and it's a liability system, how is it that there's really ever any debts when it comes to depositors and repayments? If they can create for every dollar, $12, isn't it a falsity that banks are really ever in debt in that context?
Well, it's all on their books, and they do have to balance their books. That's the catch. They can create as many loans as they can get borrowers. They're not limited at all in the amount of loans they can create. It used to be they were limited by the reserve requirement, but now that's pretty much obsolete because they've figured out how to get around it. But where the limit comes in, let's say you create $1,000 of loans on your books. Let's say you've got $100 in your capital, and you create loans on top of that worth $1,000. And so that will create an asset for you. So now you've got $1,100 in assets, and you've also got $1,000 in liabilities because that money goes into somebody's checking account and they can draw checks on it. So that's a liability to the bank.
I get that part.
Okay, now if that loan goes bad, as long as the bank can call that loan a paying loan, they've got the asset. Even if the guy doesn't pay, that's why the banks are hanging on to all these bad mortgages and they're not foreclosing because they don't want to write them off their books. But if they have to write that loan off, so now they no longer have that $1,000 asset, but they still have the $1,000 liability. So now they're bankrupt because they don't have the assets to balance their liabilities.
But what about the other 11,000 they just created out of thin air? What happens to that? So let's say they lose the $1,000 from, let's say, me, a depositor, right? Let's say I can't repay my $1,000, but they just took out another 11,000 to do business, right? They could take out up to another $11,000, right? Or $12,000 based on my $1,000. Is that correct?
I guess I missed your.
Well,
if you walk into the bank with your $1,000 and you put $1,000 into the bank, yeah, they could create $9,000 in loans on top of that.
Okay, so let's say they create $9,000 in loans. I mean, they're basically creating a massive financial machine by that capacity.
True, but they've not only created an asset for themselves; they've created a liability for themselves, and that's why. That's why they can go bankrupt.
Okay.
It's like if you make a loan to Russia and Russia defaults, you're bankrupt.
Okay.
If you don't, so even big banks can go bankrupt because they make very big loans.
In the article, there's a section of it called Making the Creditors Whole, where you talk about if a debtor nation refuses to pay, the burden shifts to the creditors to make themselves whole. You talked about the first option is to remove the obligation on banks to maintain parity between assets and liabilities. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I was quoting a man named...
Michael?
Yeah, Michael Robotham in England.
Yes.
And so he's saying that because all debt is just created on the books of banks, if... Say you had some overarching institution that, like a bankruptcy court, an international bankruptcy court, and the debtor goes into bankruptcy court and says, "We just don't have the money." Then the court should say, "All right, the way we're going to resolve this is we're going to allow that bank to carry that bad debt on its books." So it's just like when we were talking about if you took out a $1,000 mortgage and then you didn't pay it, I'm going to have a $1,000 hole on the asset side of my books. But if the bank says, all right, you don't have to pay it because you don't have the money, and we understand, you know, you've made your case and you're bankrupt, and go away and don't do it again. But we're going to let the creditor carry that on the books, on its books, as if it was a good asset. In other words, you don't have to you don't have to show that on your books as a hole in your books that's going to ruin your asset base. So it's just an accounting thing. And in fact, that's what they've done in China for years. They carry a lot of bad debt on their bank's books, and they just don't worry about it. It's just like we've got $12 trillion of bad debt in the U.S. that the U.S. is never going to pay that debt back, but we don't worry about it. We just carry that on the books, and we keep rolling it over from year to year. Well, in China, they don't have that, but because originally the way the Chinese system was set up, it was all just accounting. It was all state-owned. So they just figured out actually, I learned this because somebody from China wrote to me and told me all these details. It was very interesting.
That's amazing.
The internet is the most amazing thing. I mean, I feel like the CIA. I've got all these people reporting to me from all over the world.
Hey, you know what you should do on your site? You should put a Google Translate on it so people can read it in every language.
Ooh, hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah, you're already using WordPress, so just put a Google Translate button on there. Then anybody who comes can put it in any language, and you can make it easier for people from different countries. I notice you've published in Sweden and in Germany, correct?
Uh-huh, and Korean.
Wow.
Free translations.
I think that's awesome. That's awesome. How's your book doing?
It's fine. You know, it's self-published, so it's hard for me to even judge, but I'm certainly busy. And I guess it was a bestseller in Korea and Germany. And in Sweden, they want me to do a book tour in April. And he said I would be a big draw because everybody knows my name there, which is so odd because, you know, I don't speak Swedish. I've never been to Sweden.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Talk about the second option in canceling, which is to cancel the debt bonds and permit banks to retain them for purposes of accountancy. Is that similar to the first option or different?
Yeah, well, he's just saying you could either write it off both sides of the books, or you could leave it on the books but allow them to carry it as if it were a performing asset when it isn't.
Isn't all of the, when you really take a step back and look at the accounting of banks, is it not the biggest racket on the planet, one of them? What
For
is
sure.
it? What
it
is it?
It is, but then you have to distinguish. A lot of people think that the fault is allowing banks to issue credit. But actually, credit is the magic thing that has made the world go round for a long time. Credit is actually a good thing. The problem is that the credit is issued privately by banks that are pretending to have money that they don't have. So, A, it's a problem for the banks because right now they're all in trouble. But it's also obviously a problem for us because we're being forced to pay interest on a debt that didn't really exist. Here's the way the whole thing works. Somebody explained this, and I thought it was a great analogy. The creditor or the seller wants his money now. The buyer doesn't have it. The buyer says, "Trust me to pay you over time, and I'll pay you some extra." But the seller doesn't know the buyer, and so he doesn't trust the buyer. So they go to this third party called the bank that's been in town a long time, and everybody, you know, acknowledges that it's a stable member of society. And the bank says, okay, we'll pretend to have the money and and we'll, you know, we'll write it into your account. And, you know, it's all numbers on a screen, so it'll all work. Everybody allows us to do this. And then you'll pay us back. And for us taking the risk that maybe you won't pay, we'll collect double over 30 years, double or more. Over 30 years, but that's fair because we're taking a big risk here. We might be found out in this fraud, you know. The shell game might fall apart because we might not be able to shuffle all these numbers between different banks. So that's the way it worked, but the problem is it gives them the power over everything. They've got the power to, they use that power to create credit to buy up businesses all around the world. They buy up the media, so therefore we're not getting the straight story, we're getting their story. They buy up all the legislators. I mean, they're capable of doing that because you can't really keep your position if you don't go along with what they say.
In the first show that we did, there was a section of the show where we were talking about M3, the money supply. And you were explaining something very critical about the fact that, I'm paraphrasing, but you'll remember, that issuing credit is not necessarily going to create inflation or blow out the money supply if it's for goods and services. Can you explain that? Because a lot of people think that if you create credit, if you issue credit, you're blowing out M3.
It doesn't hurt. It's fine to issue credit as long as you're using it to create something. So what causes inflation is, the technical term is when demand exceeds supply. And demand means the amount of money competing for the goods. So you can see it, for example, if there's one house that everybody wants. And so there's only that one house, and all the rich people want that house. So they keep overbidding on the house, and they drive the price up. That's your typical inflation. But if the money is being created to create something, in other words, if you make widgets with it, let's say you have a fixed number of widgets. Let's say you have 10 widgets and $10, your price is going to be $1 per widget. But if you now have $100 competing for those 10 widgets, you'll drive the price up to $10 a widget. But if you use that $100 to make widgets and you make 100 widgets, the price is still going to be $1 a widget. So it's a question of what you use the money for. If you use it to speculate, which is merely making money off of making money, obviously you're going to drive, that's inflationary because you're not making any real products. But if you put it into the real GDP, they now can count financial products in the GDP, but they're not anything. They're not real products. But if you put real products, use your money to create real products and real services, then all you've done is expand the economy and you haven't driven up prices. And this has been shown historically. I mean, look at China. China has had money pouring into it for centuries, that people would come with their gold and silver and buy all the Chinese trinkets. And all that money flooding the Chinese economy did not drive prices up. Why not? Because they used it to make more and more stuff.
That's a very important basis for understanding the issuing of credit and how it won't inflate the money supply and cause a collapse. Because I think there's confusion in the perception of, some people equate the issuing of credit like just printing money. And when you made that distinction, it really helped me think about it. And I'm sure for people listening, it helped them too.
The other factor in inflation is that everybody knows that the Federal Reserve is creating M0, which is lots of dollar bills and lots of dollar credit in their, on their books, which they're then extending to banks. But what most people are missing here, the factor that's missing, is that a huge hole was created in our money supply when what's called the shadow lenders went away. It used to be the banks would create, say you're allowed to create $9 of loan for every $1 deposit. So they would be fully loaned up, and they would have $10 of liabilities out there. And then they would bundle those loans up and sell them off to investors. And then they would have more room on their books, and they can make yet more loans and yet more loans and yet more loans. And that's how they generated that whole housing bubble. But then in the summer of 2007, there were two Bear Stearns hedge funds that went bankrupt, and they had to show their books, or they had to put their collateralized debt obligations up for sale. These are the these bundles of mortgages that had subprime mortgages in them, but they were supposedly protected by derivatives, which is a whole other subject, but they're just basically bets. It was supposedly insured, but it's not insurance because nobody checks to make sure that the party on the other side of the bet has the money to pay up. So instead of paying up, they were going bankrupt.
How is this? It's amazing that this even goes on. It's such a high level of fraud. It's just unfathomable. It's staggering. The fraud is just so deep. It's like a deep level matrix.
Uh-huh. And it's because it's all numbers. It's so easily hidden. You don't have goods stashed away in your warehouse somewhere. So when the shadow lenders went away, so then nobody wanted to buy these collateralized debt obligations. They put them up for sale, and they weren't worth anything because there was no market for them. And then there was a panic around the world because if theirs weren't worth anything, then all these collateralized debt obligations owned by all these funds and sitting on the books of the banks, they weren't worth anything either. So that was when the whole credit market collapsed. And then you couldn't get investors to buy that stuff off the bank's books. So now they say they're fully loaned up, and they're right. They are fully loaned up. I mean, they've made as many loans as they can make that are good, sound loans. They can't be doing subprime anymore because nobody's going to buy this stuff off their books. And so they have to make reasonable loans, and they've already got their 9 loans for every $1 in deposits. So that, since all money is debt, all those extra mortgages have gone away. There's nobody's creating those loans anymore. And some of the old loans are getting paid back, of course, but there aren't new loans to replace them. So the money supply shrank. I read one place, $10 trillion. There's a $10 trillion hole in the money supply. So even though the Fed has pumped a couple trillion out there, they've not come anywhere near to replacing what was lost. So we're still actually in a deflationary spiral. And you can tell that because nobody can get credit. Nobody.
I was just going to say, that's what I've been hearing, that nobody can get credit. And also, what do you think about a huge consolidation of banks and banks getting bailed out but not wanting to issue the credit? I mean, it's strange.
Yeah. Well, the problem is they're actually behaving rationally because a bank is a private corporation. It's required by law to serve the interests of its shareholders. And so if it did things that were not the most, you know, if they didn't, they have to look at their quarterly profits. That's what they have to do. And so if they don't do the thing that's going to make the most money for the shareholders, they could be out of job. So they can't be making loans that are likely to default, and they can't go beyond their reserve and capital requirements because those rules are imposed on them. So they're stuck. So that's why it seems to me the solution is to set up a whole different banking system with a totally clean set of books and with deep, deep, deep assets and capital. I mean, so much capital that there's no way we're going to run out of capital in the state. If we make it a DBA of the state, which is what in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota is listed as North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. That means the state is the bank. So everything the state owns, the bank owns.
I'm sure that there are people out there who could be extremely excited about this, but it is a paradigm shift of thinking because many people think that if the state gets in charge of something, that it'll just be another fat cat misusing and abusing its power. There's a lot of people afraid about the power of states. So that's the other side of it. But it's a paradigm shift of thinking once you know the mechanism that can create the money on a parallel level. Probably it'll function as well as the stewardship that's going to be making it happen, like everything else. Mm-hmm. But I was speaking with Dr. Kavari the other day in an interview, who's running for governor, who was on our first show together. And I said to him, we can reconstruct the whole banking system and we can go ahead and issue a state bank. He fell in love with your idea about your revelation about the Bank of North Dakota and has it on his game plan to do that in Florida. But I asked him the question, what he thought about the whole credit system and the way the credit system is designed, not so much the banks issuing credit, but for individuals getting credit. And I said to him, if that model and that paradigm is not changed in association with setting up what's new, then you really don't have a new thing. You have a more of the same, because you can create a criteria which most people will be enslaved by rather than being able to create by. When you're setting up a new banking system and monetizing a new economy through state chartered banks, there's a whole other side of it. There's another end of it, which has to do with the consumer end, the consumer that's going to get credit. Muhammad Yunus set up the Grameen Bank, and he changed the rules and the game and the paradigm and the structure. They don't have a credit system the way we do here in America, where you have X number of points and you have to check your credit. And if something happens, it's on your credit report for 7 years and that whole thing. So he created something different and showed that most people would be reliable. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole other piece of like a whole systems approach to the whole thing while the state chartered banks are going on.
Mm-hmm. They actually charge 16% interest at the Grameen Bank. So it's, I mean, I was reading it on their website that it's a much better deal than what those poor women used to have, which was 200 or 300% interest.
But it's still too much money. I agree.
But that's why the state bank is a step up from that, because as Dr. Kavari laid out in his numbers, you could charge 2% interest. And you're still going to make 18% interest because you are taking your capital base and fanning it into 9 times that sum in loans. So you're lending that 2% money out 9 times. So you're getting 18%.
I love that. And he also had, interesting in his book, a whole other take on the GDP that's interesting that I had him talk about on the last show. But how far do you think we are from being able to have a trial with a state-owned bank?
Well, they're actually, things are getting close in Michigan. There are actually discussions with important people there. There are people working on this that they kind of want to keep a low profile, you know, because you don't want to call out the big guns before you've got your ducks in the row.
I hear you. Sounds
but
good.
But there are definitely things happening, and I think it'll definitely happen, because what other alternative is there? I mean, states are strapped. And, for instance, in New Mexico, they exploited that state with, I guess it was mining. But anyway, it's like been stripped to make money, and the money went, I think it was to Lehman Brothers. Anyway, the money was lost. So they are like hopping mad. They do not want to be sending more money out to Wall Street. So if they can set up an alternative system that works, they'll be ecstatic. It seems to me that once you set up such a bank, people are so annoyed at the regular banks, or particularly the Wall Street banks, you know, the out-of-state banks, the big out-of-state banks, that they will flee to this state bank. They'll support it as a matter of patriotic duty.
It sounds very, very exciting. Very, very exciting. One more thing I want to ask you about the state of Guernsey, the island state of Guernsey, located in the Channel Islands between England and France. In this article, you talked about it. It has funded infrastructure with government-issued money for over 200 years without price inflation and government debt. Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And why was Guernsey able to do that? Because it was issuing its own currency?
Yes, and that's the thing. And they just declared that the government would never go into debt. They would just issue currency for what they needed. They don't have an inflation problem. They built all this infrastructure. They desperately needed infrastructure. And some sane person looked around and said, well, this is insane. We have the workers. We have the materials. The roads and the walls are falling apart. We need to rebuild this stuff. The only thing we're lacking is the money. So let's just issue it, call it payment. You know, we, the community, acknowledge that the work has been done. We're going to issue you little receipts and say, here, you've been paid. This is your money. Go spend it. We, the people of the community, will honor those little sheets of paper and acknowledge that they're worth, you know, your hourly wage, whatever it was you put into it. And that has worked for hundreds of years. And the reason that they haven't been jumped all over like bigger countries that have tried it, I think, is just that they're little and they were under the radar and nobody worried about them. They thought, oh, well, it's a little island off the coast.
A successful infrastructure program funded with interest-free national credit was also instituted in New Zealand, you write here, after it elected its first Labour government in the 1930s. Very exciting. What happened to New Zealand after that?
It worked very well. They funded all this housing, and so they did housing developments that they had very low rents on them, and it was all funded with national credit. In other words, they just created the money on their books. It was the same deal where they hired the people and they paid them with the national credit, and that served as money. I mean, it was money. You know, it was just checking accounts, and you draw in your checking account, and you pay with checks, and it goes out into the community. But what happened to their publicly owned central bank was that I think it was in the 50s, it was said that, well, the economy is now back on its feet, so that was an emergency measure. You know, we don't need to do that anymore. And apparently England, the Bank of England, leaned on them and said that they would be cut off from the British Commonwealth, from trade with the British Commonwealth, and they felt that they were dependent on that. And so if they didn't, you know, fall in line with all the others and privatize, so they did.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been listening to Ellen Brown, a California attorney and author of 11 books, including Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. It's available in English, Swedish, German, and Korean. And you can visit Ellen Brown at ellenbrown.com and also at webofdebt.com. Ellen, is there anything else you'd like to say as we hit the top of the hour and close this interview today?
Well, I just want to thank you for interviewing me. That was most interesting.
Thank you. It's always interesting with you, and you're doing great and much needed work. And thank you so much for all your dedication. And I think if anybody can facilitate this, it's you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for laying out the educational material necessary for us to understand and have even a semblance of what's going on.
Thank you.
Many blessings.